Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's the local news roundup. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson files a defamation suit against CNN after the network reported the Republican gubernatorial candidate made racist and misogynistic comments on a porn website about a decade ago. The debate over toll lanes on I-77 continues. This week, local officials weigh in on the plan to create a public-private partnership to build and run express toll lanes from uptown Charlotte to the South Carolina border. And the fallout from Hurricane Helene continues as misinformation runs rampant in western North Carolina. We look at what efforts state and local officials are taking to combat this and how it may impact the election as early voting begins. Finally, a benefit concert for Helene victims continues to grow with more artists added for the October 26th show at Bank of America Stadium. Here to discuss these stories are Nick Oxner, WBTV's chief investigative reporter; Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve; Hunter Sines is reporter at WSOC; and last but not least, Eli Portillo is senior editor at WFAA News. I am struggling this morning. Good morning and welcome to you all.
Good morning. Got that election feeling close.
Morning.
You're already tired.
I was going to say, I need to let y'all speak so I can stop.
It's so darn excited.
Nick is in mid-season form. Let's begin with Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. On Tuesday, Robinson held a news conference in Raleigh to disclose details of his lawsuit against CNN. Here's Jesse Banal, one of Robinson's attorneys.
The lawsuit that we filed today is the first step, the first fruit of that investigation.
At that same press conference, Robinson maintained his innocence while calling CNN's reporting an act of political interference.
We are glad to take these first steps to fight back against what we consider to be one of the greatest examples of political interference in this state's history and quite possibly this nation's history.
And Robinson says he's unwavering in his stance that he's innocent.
We're standing and fighting. Regardless of who turned and ran away from us, regardless of who doesn't believe us, regardless of who does, we know what the truth is, and we're ready to stand and fight.
Hunter, I'm going to start with you. How would you describe what we heard and saw from Mark Robinson and his legal team this week?
Well, I think it's what many expected. I think it was the same type of explanation and show that we have seen from the lieutenant governor since this bombshell report came out. He called it a high-tech lynching on a candidate who he says has been targeted from day one from people who just don't want to see him in office. But what was most interesting wasn't what was in the 16-page lawsuit, but it was what was not in that lawsuit. There were no exhibits. There was no detailed explanation into how CNN and their reporting was inaccurate or wrong. There were statements saying that it was false and that was wrong. But there was not a detailed exhibit saying who it was instead making those posts instead of Lieutenant Governor Robinson. At this point, I think the most that you could gain from the lieutenant governor and his team's explanation on this is that they say that CNN chose to publish this report despite knowing, I believe they said, or recklessly disregarding was the language, that Lieutenant Governor Robinson's data, like his passwords, his emails, his name, date of birth, were all stolen in a data breaches from years past, and that anybody could have taken that data and made that account on that porn website known as Nude Africa. So that is where I think they are going with this. But again, there were no detailed explanations on who else it could have been.
Did anyone ask the question that you're posing, or the information you're relaying, that would prompt the question of, hey, what about refuting, rebutting this?
I was not there at that press conference, as you and I talked before in Raleigh, but I, and this is a biased journalism thing, there were some very good pointed questions at that press conference, including that. And basically, they their explanation and answers is that, well, this will allow us to go into that next discovery phase because so many people like CNN, the owner and operator of this Nude Africa website, are not working with Robinson's attorneys and their teams when they have reached out trying to get that information. But this, they are saying, is the first step to allowing that discovery phase, whether it be through search warrants or court orders and things like that. That is how they are answering that question right now.
Elon.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that in addition to starting discovery and opening up, you know, some of CNN, CNN will also get to conduct discovery and, you know, subpoena things and try to get the same sorts of information from Mark Robinson. I'm not a lawyer, but I have taken media law classes, and public figures have to pass a really high bar in order to successfully pursue defamation suits. You know, they have to prove not just that the information was false, but that it was published, you know, with reckless disregard and actual malice, you know, intending to maliciously cause harm. And it is very difficult in this country for public figures like politicians to sue people for libel. And, you know, I think doubly so without really strong evidence. You know, just saying we said this is wrong and CNN published it anyway does not meet the definition for libel for a public figure. It's not close to it.
I've got a busy queue. Nick, then Hunter, then Ryan.
But because there's so much to talk about with this story. look, here's the other thing is we're already on version 2.0 of explanation behind this, because in the moments after this, or as the story is breaking, including when Mark Robinson did an interview with Andrew Kaczynski of CNN for the story, he said that this was AI generated. So now, you know, as Hunter just said, at the press conference this week, we got, well, someone compromised his passwords. But the reason they're having to go to these explanations that are shifting is because let's not forget that this was these were a series of posts made under a screen name that Robinson has used across the internet when an account linked to his email that he has used elsewhere, and that in fact used the name Mark Robinson.
And that were carried out long before he was a public figure.
More than a decade ago, yeah. Right? And so first you said these are AI generated. Now we're hearing the lawsuit, you know, this is someone who breached my data explanation. But we should also remember that, and in the bite that you played from the lieutenant governor at his press conference this week, we should point out it's not just a couple people who left who aren't working for him anymore. It was his entire top staffs from both his campaign and then his official office, you know, have all resigned, which is again quite a repudiation from the people who had stuck by you for a very long time.
And before, Hunter, before I let you, I just want to remind people, if anyone's kind of lost the thread here, this is the CNN story from about a month ago where there were posts about being a black Nazi, about wanting to buy slaves, about transgender pornography. So very, very damning, assuming that this is true. Go on, Hunter.
Well, you would think damning if true, but in this political climate, this person
Fair
is
point.
Still in the race and still being supported. But yes, I get what you were saying, Eric. I wanted to kind of go a little bit a step further with what Nick was just saying. It's also notable of who was not at that press conference. You know, when we see Donald Trump go through his, you know, his court proceedings, there were congressmen and senators up there at these press conferences supporting him. There were no other state Republicans standing there with him at this press conference. I think that is notable. We've seen many of them come out and say, you need proof by a certain date or to drop out. Of course, that has not happened. But I do think it's notable on the official things. But when you go out to the campaign trail, I'm sure Nick and others can talk and allude to this when you talk to voters, I don't think this really has an impact on his base for sure. And I don't really know, at least in this race, if there are a lot of the undecided voters because it is such a different climate between each candidate.
Ryan, you've been waiting patiently. Go.
Right. Just to build on something Eli said earlier about, I think that he and his lawyers know that this is not going to reach any level of defamation in the real legal system. But for those who don't know, there are these things called SLAPP lawsuits that are called, they stand for strategic lawsuits against public participation. And they're usually used in this sort of way to either drain money from a defendant or whomever they're filed against, or to, in this case, I believe, I don't think they're trying to drain CNN of their money, but I think they are there to waste time until we get past November so that he has something to point to and just say, hey, don't kick me out of this race just yet. I'm suing CNN, who we all on the Republican side think are the bad guys. And I think it's a different kind of SLAPP lawsuit, but still one. And just want to mention as a journalist that North Carolina does not have legislation against SLAPP lawsuits, as I, as a newspaper owner, believe we should. Many states do. And this could be thrown out quite easily under that sort of legislation.
Yeah, that's right. And we should also note that the other defendant in this lawsuit is a man named Lewis Love Money, who's a former Greensboro Porn Shop employee who sparked a story in the Assembly online news site that said Mark Robinson had been a frequent, 5-day-a-week visitor to his and other porn shops in the 90s. He's a private citizen. He is stuck with his story even after this lawsuit, but he's someone who could certainly see funds drained by defending a major defamation lawsuit. And also, Hunter mentioned Robinson's base. I think the latest poll I saw was 54-32. So Robinson is possibly headed for a very large defeat in this race.
You're listening to Charlotte Talks. On that latter point, Eli, I think Hunter mentioned this is not going to affect his base, but there is roughly, I think, a 12-point, maybe 15-point gap between Trump's numbers and Robinson's numbers.
Yeah, and if you look at this, this poll from Morning Consult of about 1,100 likely voters, they've actually got a 22-point difference between lead for Stein, and that's about a 19-point difference for lagging Trump. So this is
Robinson was already 12 points behind before the trans porn, anti-Semitic, racist posts, and so it was not good. And it's obviously politically debilitating when you suddenly get dropped from all the Donald Trump rallies. I saw someone showed me last night a kind of poll card that has, your conservative slate of candidates that was going around that started with Hal Weatherman, the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, and just totally, omitted Mark Robinson off the literature at all. We should still note, though, that in spite just about everybody distancing themselves from Mark Robinson, the state Republican Party's official line is that they still support him because he has denied this. And so the official party line of the Republicans in North Carolina is that they still stand by him.
We have much more to talk about politically with presidential candidates and all of their surrogates descending on North Carolina, sometimes on Nick Oxner's house alone. And we also have a lot more to say about I-77 and Hurricane Helene. All that and more coming up on the Local News Roundup. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. This is the Local News Roundup. And with me today is Nick Oxner of WBTV. Also here, Hunter Sines from WSOC, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve, and WFAE's very own Eli Portillo. Nick, I want to ask you one thing. You were talking at the end of that previous segment about the Republican Party and their official stand. And one of the things that I think at least some of us were speculating on, even before the CNN report, as Lieutenant Governor Robinson had all these controversies, is the obvious. How would that affect Trump? And we just went through the fact that Trump is still polling much higher. What about the rest of the Republican ballot, down ballot, so to speak? Is there concern among Republicans that Robinson could bring them down?
Well, I think that's why you've seen a move to kind of just take Robinson out of the equation again from everyone except the actual party. But, you know, the candidates that are at Trump rallies aren't talking. They're at Trump rallies. They're not with Robinson, who's doing, you know, right, full swing of events around the state, still campaigning. And, you know, they're hoping to tie themselves to Donald Trump and that momentum and not Mark Robinson. But, you know, even with Trump polling higher, the big danger for him is that, you know, Robinson's going to be a blunt of on the ground enthusiasm. And at this point, where North Carolina remains just neck and neck and remains one of the two most important swing states in the country, you know, I think it's North Carolina and Pennsylvania that will decide the White House. Every person matters. And we'll talk about this more in a second when we talk about why we're being bombarded with presidential candidates. But, you know, every person matters. And so if you have anything that might blunt or take away air resources, right, for ads, like pulling Mark Robinson's advertising down from the Republican Governors Association, you know, any little calculus could be the thing that makes you lose in North Carolina at this point, because it is just that close.
Eli.
Yeah, if this is a situation where this state is decided by, you know, 12,000 votes like Georgia last time around, I think we're going to be asking that question of, did Mark Robinson's alleged posts on the Nude Africa Forum more than a decade ago change the presidential election results? We'll be asking that question forever.
And to both of those points, it is a 1-point margin right now, 48.5% to 47.5% between Trump and Kamala Harris. This week, we had bus tours. We had Bill Clinton. We had J.D. Vance. I believe we had Governor Walz. Nick, since you are out and about covering a lot of these appearances, give us a rundown of who's been here and where they're going, because I think that's really interesting. Like, what is the campaign strategy in terms of what parts of North Carolina they're being sent to?
Well, I'll give you a real answer in a second, but the easy answer is everyone and everywhere. you know, so just look at my executive producer yesterday made a map that showed where they had been, and he said, take a look at this. It's wild. And it is. So, but what we have seen, especially since the hurricane hit, we've seen that the Harris-Walz campaign is doing more events kind of in, you know, the Triangle East, which is farther away, obviously, from the disaster zone. And then we've still seen Trump and Vance in areas closer to Charlotte, interestingly, and slightly further west. So, you know, yesterday, Tim Walz was in Durham with former President Bill Clinton. His, you know, running mate, the top of the ticket, Kamala Harris, was in Greenville, North Carolina this past Sunday. We had J.D. Vance, who's been to the state 3 times in under a week. So he was in Greensboro last Thursday. He was then at the Charlotte Motor Speedway for the Roval 400 on Sunday, and then was back in Wilmington. I don't know what day it is now, but I think he was there Wednesday. And then we see Donald Trump, who's going to span the state this coming Monday, with events in Greenville, North Carolina, at the same place Kamala went the other day. And then we'll be in Concord that evening for an event. And I think we're expecting guidance on additional events while he's here as well. So, and then we should also point out that both campaigns are doing these bus tours on behalf of the campaign that include pretty high level surrogates, pretty big names that are going all over the state, you know, in a bus wrapped with Trump and Harris's face on them. But they're not on there. But anyway, so that's also happening now as well. We're in that phase of this.
And Nick, you just said earlier, which anyone who's following politics probably aware as well, it's North Carolina and Pennsylvania and a handful of others. Given that, I'm going to make the grand deductive leap that we're going to keep seeing this level of attention from the candidates and their surrogates right up to Election Day.
Absolutely. And it's the fact that we have seen this continued level right at this pace here in North Carolina. That's your real indicator that North Carolina is still very much in play, not only in the public polling, which, you know, always kind of gets dismissed by campaigns as, you know, oh, well, we have our private polling and it shows blah. No, my understanding from the folks that I talked to is that the private polling shows that as well. And you don't have to take their word for it. Just look at how often everyone is here, right? Donald Trump, generally speaking, must win North Carolina to win the White House. That's been the prevailing wisdom for months now. And so when you started seeing an opening there, and you start, and how you knew there was an opening is because you started after Kamala Harris became the nominee and Joe Biden dropped out. You know, Harris chose Raleigh to be the first place that she made her first major policy speech on the economy. And you saw the polls instantly tighten in North Carolina to a dead heat, you know, within 1 point within the margin of error. And so then you've seen Trump and Vance both here at least once a week each for the past month and more now. And so that's your number one signal that we remain a jump ball.
Eli.
And just wanted to point out that we are also on Sunday having a visit from Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. Just got a press release about that this morning. And she is going to visit the Al-Noor Community Center, a Muslim center in Charlotte. And the Green Party, they have been promoting Jill Stein as an alternative for Muslim voters who are unhappy with how the Biden-Harris administration is handling the war in Gaza and Lebanon and the conflicts with Israel. And they are really promoting that. And, you know, just like we're talking about, is Mark Robinson going to be a spoiler on the Republican side? You know, if Harris loses by a narrow margin in North Carolina, we'll be talking about, was Jill Stein the spoiler on for the Democrats probably for years to come.
Who says government is slow? A mere 17 years after talk of adding toll lanes to widen I-77 between Uptown and the state line, well, we're now within 10 months of something maybe happening. This week, the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization, a group made up of local government officials from Iredale, Mecklenburg, and Union counties, voted to pursue a $3.7 billion public-private toll lanes project. One reason they want to act now is because the cost of the lanes has tripled over the past decade. Here's NCDOT engineer Brett Kniep.
The scope, scale, and cost of the projects in our urban areas have really taken me by surprise.
Eli, given this vote, how likely is it that CARTPO, what a horrible acronym that is, and the state end up with a toll lane project moving forward in the next year?
Well, they are going to be putting out a request for people to bid on this, to say, raise their hand and say, hey, I'm a private company and I want to build and run your toll lanes. So we will be farther down the line than we ever have been with this, with real business proposals coming in. I think, you know, the specter of North Mecklenburg and the I-77 toll lanes still looms large, although CARTPO, I've also heard it pronounced CRITPO, but either way, it's not a great acronym. even though they voted in favor of it, you know, the city of Charlotte has a weighted vote by population and a near majority. Several of the smaller municipalities and Mecklenburg County's representative voted against this project, and there's a lot of opposition out there. So, you know, we're at the point where it's not the beginning of the end, but to quote Winston Churchill in a much less high stakes situation, it's maybe the end of the beginning.
Churchill on toll lanes. I like that. Before Wednesday's vote, Charlotte City Council weighed in on Monday with unanimous support, while their Mecklenburg County counterparts opposed it by a 5-4 margin. Here's Council Member Dimple Ashmira.
We talk about equity all the time. So this is really an equity issue, because how do we ensure that we are being equitable in relieving congestion in all parts of our city?
County Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell reached a different conclusion.
And I believe that managed lanes add to the economic disparities that already exist in our community. The wealthy can move through swiftly, and everyone else can remain in congested lanes.
So somebody sort this out for me. Which is it? Are toll lanes helping equity or hindering equity?
Well, I think it's...
go ahead, Hunter.
I think it's how what kind of equity you're looking at. If you're looking at like the mobility equity and actually getting somewhere faster versus getting somewhere an hour and a half later, sure, I see what Dimple is saying. But I also see if you're looking at the financial equity for this region and you see Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell's words on this, I think she has some sense to what she's saying. I mean, when you look at the toll lanes going north, they can be as expensive as like a dollar a mile during rush hour. When you're talking about the cost of living in this city, affordable housing crisis that we have, not everyone is going to be able to pay that. And so I think she has a point in what she is saying that, sure, the rich are going to be able to get down to South Carolina a bit faster. But what about everybody else? They're going to be stuck in traffic. But to kind of cancel out both of their points in a way, one of the commissioners had actually said, well, what is another solution? Because all the experts are telling us that this is the only solution. So if you have one, bring it to the table. So that's why some of these people have chosen to vote. Not all of them, but some of them.
And that is an important point that I want to piggyback on. I was going to wait to make it, but now Hunter just teed me up so well, is that it's the only solution because of the funding formula that the state applies to transportation that says North Carolina, or that says the Charlotte region, I refuse to say either of your words, so that the CRTPO administers is only eligible for X number of dollars per person. I did a story about a year ago that really made everyone on the Outer Banks angry, where I went and rode a ferry. And if you look at the dollar per person spent to operate the ferry system in that part of the state, which is vital, they need it. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have ferries in the Outer Banks. But what I am saying is if you spent on transportation at the same level the state spends to operate the ferry system as it is to get us interstates that you can actually move on in Charlotte, then we wouldn't need toll lanes. And the reason we need toll lanes is because the state is saying under the funding formula, you're not going to qualify to get enough money to build free lanes for another, what is it, 15 or 20 years or something like that? And so we could have them if we wanted. The state has decided Charlotte doesn't warrant any more money, even though we have more people. I would also like to give Hunter a shout out for saying for the first time that an elected official on this radio show is making some sense and logical. So.
History has been made. It's a good thing Churchill was invoked earlier. Eli, I want to ask you, a lot of talk about the toll lanes this week was about the process and what happened in North Mecklenburg and how this time will be different. So what is the definition of a more open process in contrast to what we saw last time around?
Well, you know, I think key will be getting more interested companies, having the bids be, you know, openly discussed, and having people in the public have a chance to weigh in. Last time around, there was a sense that really, you know, when Cintra, the Spanish company that built and now runs those toll lanes, was selected, that it was rammed through over everyone's objections. I've covered some of those meetings, and I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's fair to say that there wasn't public input, because I sat through many of those very long meetings myself, and there was certainly lots of input from the public and elected officials. But there was a sense, especially from people who live in North Mecklenburg, that the die was cast, it was done, it was going to be this company building these toll roads no matter what they said. I think to some degree you're already seeing that discontent starting to build in South Charlotte. So it's going to be interesting to see if this process can cancel that out.
Because first there was a glimmer of hope that there may not need to be toll lanes. And then, no, we must have toll lanes. And then, oh, could it be state-run toll lanes, like when the Monroe Expressway, which is, you know, a quarter of the cost, basically, of the I-77 North toll lanes. And then now the state said, no, it can't be public tolls. And so it's every little thing gets back to in the same way. Sorry, Ryan, you politely raised your hand and I jumped in.
No, you're good. But I just have already seen in these recent meetings starting 2 weeks ago, some revisionist history being revised again and again within the meeting itself. In that NCDOT's presentation, we're saying, well, Central was the only company that was interested at the, for the North Mecklenburg toll lane. So we just had to go with them. And this time we looked to make it more open. And then you saw Ed Driggs sort of go back on that right before the meeting ended 2 weeks ago and say, well, you know, I just want everyone to know that Centra actually did a really great job. And from what I'm hearing from sources, that Centra is very much a part of this process and wants to be the lead once again. And Driggs probably knows that, but he's already trying to tell people, well, don't make it sound like they did the worst job in the world. They actually did really great. So it's going to be some heated arguments. It's going to be another 9-month process before you even get RFPs. So there's going to be time to discuss this, but it's going to get heated.
You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And Hunter, were you wanting to say something about the toll lanes?
Yeah, I was. I mean, really quick to follow up that is, sure, some may think that it went really well, but I believe this is the project that they were getting fined like millions of dollars a day for how late they went on even opening these tolls. So let's keep that in mind when our leaders say that it was a really job well done. I will say, I think what's going to be another head scratcher when we get to this point, when all of these, or maybe just one bid, but bids are coming in to do this, is the reminder that this private company will build it, will set the tolls, and will profit all of the money that is made from these tolls. Other states do it other ways, a reminder, where some of that funding goes towards their public education funds. So I think a big, how do I say this on the radio, factor that really gets people heated and upset will be the fact that there's no return for your investment for really driving on this toll lane in any capacity. Somebody is literally pocketing off of all of these drivers, many of which are just trying to get home every single day.
Yeah, and if it's anything like the North toll lanes, there's going to be a guarantee that the state pays them if they don't make money.
We're going to have to leave it there for the moment. By the way, that's a 50-year contract for everyone scoring at home. That's the likely length of the private toll lane operator contract. We will have more on this story, I'm sure, coming up in the weeks ahead. Stay with us for more on the Local News Roundup right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to the Local News Roundup with our panel of experts, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Ryan Pitkin of Queen City Nerve, WSOC's Hunter Sines, and WFAE's Eli Portillo. The western part of our state continues to suffer from the effects of Hurricane Helene. Beyond the staggering physical and financial challenges, misinformation has become a huge problem. Governor Cooper condemned such behavior this week. Here's what he said.
If you're participating in spreading this stuff, stop it. Whatever your aim is, the people you are really hurting are those in western North Carolina who need help.
And Nick, you asked Donald Trump Jr. this week whether the rhetoric needs to be toned down based on threats made against FEMA workers. Here's what he told you.
You know, I haven't seen that. Like I said, the communities that I saw, they didn't really notice much of that president. It was, you know, Samaritan's Purse that was doing that. I don't know if there's, you know, an offshoot of a couple people that are this. That's the stuff that always gets the attention. What doesn't get the attention is the community.
What do you make of that answer, Nick?
Well, it was mostly a non-answer, and I asked him, that was the second in three questions that I, you know, posed to him surrounding the rhetoric from him and more importantly, his dad, the former president, Donald Trump, just putting out, you know, things that are clearly not true. The former president has said that there are no helicopters in Western North Carolina. He said that Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has directed his staff in his administration to help only Democrat voters in Western North Carolina. Both of those patently false. And so he doubled down on that. He called that Donald Trump Jr. Called those statements accountability and said that that prompted additional response from the federal government. All of this is just, you know, not true. The federal government is on the ground. I think there seems to be wide alignment that maybe there were some kinks in getting the federal aid from, you know, kind of a top level and distributed through the communities. There are lots of logistical challenges. But, you know, these continued claims just are not accurate.
FEMA spokesperson Shirley Tracy spoke to NPR affiliate WFDD in Winston-Salem this week about what it actually looks like when FEMA is at a location.
We've been in all of the counties, as I said, that's with search and rescue first. Now, that may not look like FEMA. They may not be wearing blue shirts with the logo on the front, but that is the result of FEMA. We have people who are search and rescue, then we have people bringing in commodities for the immediate situation. We take all of those mass quantities and put them at distribution sites throughout the state. Those distribution sites are where the county goes to get the water, the meals, or whatever, take it back to their county, and then distribute it to the residents. So is there a lot going on that perhaps people don't see, and they say, well, where's FEMA? But FEMA is there.
Eli, one of the things I was wondering as we're watching this play out the last couple of weeks is, how likely do you think it is that we're going to start seeing a normalization of this kind of misinformation and division over disaster recovery?
Well, I think it's been normalized for a long time now already. You know, we already live in competing realities when it comes to events as seismic as the January 6th riots and attack on the U.S. Capitol. You know, you have people on the right saying, oh, it was the FBI, it was all some kind of false flag, fake attack, or it was actually peaceful. And, you know, then you have the footage that everyone saw live on TV in many cases and has seen repeated for hundreds of times after that. So I don't think it's any stretch to say we're going to be living in competing realities when it comes to disaster relief now. The idea of objective, nonpartisan reality, unfortunately, I think has been somewhat shattered for a long time by everything from the internet and social media to, you know, the echo chambers and rank partisanship that we fall into.
Ryan.
And I, you know, there's been some situations here where there's misinformation on top of misinformation, where you had an original sheriff's report in Rutherfordton quoted as saying that there's trucks full of people hunting FEMA workers, and later turned out a couple of days later to, they turned back on that and said it was one guy with an assault rifle, which is very dangerous. And there are definitely those people out there. But the truck full of people was repeated en masse throughout national media. And then you have AI, which is throwing its own misinformation into the ring. And you've got these photos that look ridiculous, but a lot of people on Facebook believe them, of people getting saved. And they're not even political on their face, but they get turned political one way or another. And it's really just a sort of a soup of what to believe for folks who are not all that media literate and aren't up on sort of things that AI generated or not.
Yeah. And Eli, not to be a pessimist, but of course, with the election already underway and election day 2.5 weeks away, you know, I think in some ways, Helene and this flood of misinformation and disinformation we've seen could be somewhat of a dry run for what we will see after the election. I mean, assuming it's close in a lot of the swing states, you know, I think you'll probably see a lot of pretty outrageous claims based on, you know, stuff that it's going to be hard to say. Ryan mentioned AI. It's going to be hard to say if it's true or not. And, you know, the average person out there, like, I know that my news consumption is probably like top 1% of the U.S. I spend all day on national news, local news. I had to take Twitter off my phone because it was, you know, taking so much of my time. The average person who is not me does not have hours a day to sort through whether a photo of an election worker, you know, dumping a box of ballots off the back of a truck is AI generated or is from Moldova in 2016 or is really from Pennsylvania or what the context of that is. People, more than the specific disinformation, people don't have time in their lives, and they shouldn't have time in their lives because there's things besides politics, to shovel out from the flood of, you know, crap that we're being deluged by day in and day out, which is why it's important to listen to a reliable source like public radio.
Speaking of elections and the storm, early voting started this week, and North Carolina Elections Director Karen Brinson Bell spoke at a press conference telling reporters she doesn't expect major problems with voting sites, even in counties hardest hit by Helene.
The vast majority are going to be open and available to the voters in some shape or form. It might require a generator, it might require a porta potty, but we are getting those sites open.
What have we heard so far about early voting, whether it's in Western North Carolina or here in Mecklenburg County? Well, we have all of the day's evidence. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did a little anecdotal reporting yesterday, driving around looking at poll sites, and the lines were very long. The one nearest to the studio where I am right now, the former Kohl's store on North Tryon Street, there was a line of people wrapping around this department store building. There was no parking in front. There was, you know, gridlock, people trying to maneuver to the curb to let voters out, pick them up, or do curbside voting. So there were definitely long lines in part of the city. In Western North Carolina, 76 out of 80 planned early voting sites in the hard-hit counties are open, so nearly all of them. Some of them had to be relocated, you know, as you heard the director say, some of them might be on generators or porta potties, but 95% of the sites that they had planned to open in Western North Carolina are in fact open for early voting now.
And early voting runs through November 2nd
at 3 p.m.
At 3 p.m. But who's counting? On Monday in Southern Pines, Mo Green and Michelle Morrow, who are running for superintendent of public instruction, debated. Morrow, who homeschooled her children and who has not worked in public education, said that her lack of experience makes her a better candidate because the system is broken.
It's important experience, but I think one of my greatest qualifications is that I have no experience in a failing system that chooses to continue to fund failures.
And Mo Green said during the debate in Southern Pines that he's against using public money for private school vouchers. Instead, he wants to see more money going to public schools.
And I'm not typically one that likes to always lift up funding, but we've reached a point where this is the issue.
Eli, how did Morrow and Green do? Any surprises in this debate?
You know, the one thing that surprised me is actually how much discussion of policy there was. They actually talked about issues, and, you know, Michelle Morrow talked about how she wants to audit the education spending and, you know, squeeze more efficiency out of the department and out of schools. Mo Green talked about how, no, we need to increase funding. Michelle Morrow talked about wanting two school resource officers, law enforcement officers in every school. That would be very expensive. So don't know how you square that with the reducing spending. But, you know, there was less of the general overall vitriol. And there was some discussion of, you know, Mo Green brought up that Michelle Morrow had falsely said that the plus in LGBTQ plus means pedophiles, which does not. He did bring that up. But there was less of the overall talk about, like, her past comments about possibly executing Barack Obama on pay-per-view. Like, that stuff did not dominate this debate, which I had, you know, frankly kind of expected because it's dominated the race so far.
Although we should point out that almost none of those policy things that Eli just highlighted that they discussed, which is, you know, substantive, is anything in the purview of the state superintendent of public instruction.
Good point.
That's a very important point. That's a very important point. I had that thought as well. Another debate this week, the candidates for insurance commissioner, Mike Causey, the current commissioner, said his office has been looking into flood insurance as an issue since Hurricane Florence hit in 2018.
We brought in the flood experts, and it generally says if it rains where you live, you need flood insurance.
And Democratic challenger Natasha Marcus, state senator from Mecklenburg County, said she wants to see flood maps updated so people can have the information they need to prepare for future storms like Helene. And she said these storms are more frequent due to climate change.
The number of policies that have flood insurance, or the number of homeowners that have flood insurance in Asheville is less than 1%, in large part because of lack of data.
So, Eli, I mean, this race all of a sudden is infinitely more interesting, I think, to a lot of voters. What did we hear this week from the candidates?
Yeah, you know, Natasha Marcus has basically tried to paint Causey as kind of an insider who's too cozy with insurance and not taking a hard line with them, you know, negotiating rate increases. She wants to hold them accountable, she says, with more public hearings and forums, or public proceedings where people can really see how the sausage is made rather than, as she puts it, negotiating behind closed doors. And Causey's saying, you know, hey, I've reined these guys in. They're not getting as big increases as they wanted. I think a lot of people are paying a lot more attention both for flood insurance and because, you know, the flood insurance issue aside, insurance rates are going up dramatically for homes, and not just on the coasts, not just in floodplains, but, you know, in the end, everyone bears those rising costs. So we're likely to see much higher home insurance costs and insurance costs in general, no matter who wins, I think.
You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Nick, I'm curious, Eli was just talking about how people are going to be paying a lot more attention. Is it as simple as I want lower insurance rates and that's really the only way I'm going to judge candidates?
I'm going to disagree with my esteemed colleague, Mr. Portillo here. No one's paying attention to the insurance commissioner race. I've run a race for the Council of State position. That's the 10 statewide elected officials. And basically everything past governor gets ignored.
I just want to point out it was Eric who made that premise. So
I said it could be more higher interest because
no one's going to pay attention. But I would say that I think we could all agree that they should be, because these are important things. And let's also not
mea culpa.
Let's also not forget that that, you know, Mike Causey got elected 8 years ago to his first term by knocking off an incumbent and saying he was the outsider, and he's kind of led as a guy who wasn't in. There's a wonky web and surprising web in the insurance industry nationwide, and so he was not part of that, and so that is all fascinating. That is why these elections do matter and why people should pay attention to the race for things like superintendent of public instruction, insurance commissioner, state auditor, state treasurer. So
and obviously we're going to be talking about the elections ad nauseum here for the next few weeks, but I am curious, as we're talking about things that people don't pay attention to, Eli, we've got, what is it, $200 million plus in local bonds that are on the ballot this year. Who in the world has any awareness of that, given all the things that we have just discussed?
Yeah, that's for things like housing, transportation improvements, sidewalks, neighborhood improvements. You know, it's not the biggest bond issue, but it is something that you get to directly say, should my local government spend this money, borrow this money or not? And I would venture to say that the number of people who have studied that in depth before stepping into the polling place is not too high.
Ryan.
I just wanted to say that if you read our election issue that's on racks right now, we go into detail about each one of the bonds. Annie Keough does a great job with that. Just a shameless plug.
And shameless plug is where we're going to end, although I do want to share one small bit of good news related to Helene, and that is that the Concert for Carolina benefit coming up next weekend at Bank of America Stadium is sold out. It's sold out in one day, and more artists have signed on to perform, including the Avett Brothers, Chase Rice, and Parmalee. I hope I'm saying Parmalee right. Someone correct me if I'm not. Headliners are Eric Church, Luke Combs, and James Taylor, among others. So with that, that is the last word on concert bookings and everything else for the week, but we will have a lot more to say so that you do not go into the booth uninformed on bonds, insurance commissioners, or anything else. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks. And last but not least, thank you to Nick Oxter, Ryan Pitkin, Hunter Sines, and Eli Portillo. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.